Welcome to Intergalactic Relations, a University of Sussex podcast. On this season's podcast, we explore the liberal utopianism of Star Trek: The Next Generation. From the profound optimism of early seasons, mirroring the optimism at the end of the Cold War, to the pessimism that creeps into the show a few years later, as the inhuman results of shock therapy in the former Soviet Union and US misadventure in Somalia showed the limits of that post-Cold War order. We hope you'll learn a little about Star Trek and a little about international relations. Hello, I am Dr. Fai Sheikh, lecturer in international relations at the University of Sussex. I love Star Trek: The Next Generation, and in this episode I am quite terrified by the character of Picard, who until now was my space dad. But now I'm really not sure I want to be in a position where he might discipline me, because who knows, he might decide mass murder is the appropriate response, as we will discuss. With me are my co-hosts, Dr. Sarah Bulmer, Senior Lecturer in Politics and International Relations at the University of Exeter. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Fies. And yes, I found this episode really chilling as well.
We'll have a lot to discuss, I'm sure. And Dr. Dan Watson, Consultant Researcher on Civil Wars and Peacebuilding. Hi, Dan.
Well, hello.
For this episode, we watched I, Borg, which is Season 5, Episode 23. In this episode, the Enterprise, our protagonists, come upon a distress signal. They think it might be someone who needs help. So they go, they explore, they find a crash. But lo and behold, it's the Borg. And the Borg we met in the second episode of this podcast. And in the context of the show, there have been a few run-ins with them. They're some kind of implacable enemy, the biggest threat to this entire spacefaring civilization, let's say, our protagonist's federation. And the Borg are techno-zombies, let's say. We called them maybe techno-communists in our podcast episode about them in episode 2. So the point is, they find these enemies and nothing's changed. It was a distress signal and there is somebody who needs help. It just so happens it's the enemy. So what do you do? The crew eventually decide to bring it on board to help it recover, knowing that this puts them in danger because the big bad guys, the Borg, will come looking for this individual. So then Picard gets it into his head that they will install some kind of virus into the Borg that they have saved and then send it back on his merry way to the Borg Collective, as they're called, and this virus will infect the Borg and wipe them out. Picard's quite specific in that he hopes that it will be a terminal virus. He's, as we'll explore later, very much aware that this means mass murder, and he's happy to do it because the Borg are such an implacable foe as far as they're concerned. But as the episode continues, our crew become friends with this Borg prisoner. They nurse him back to health, and they teach him about what it means to be an individual, what it means to be part of the Federation, essentially, what it means to be human, something like this. And the Borg starts identifying with a new identity, a new name, Hugh, as he's called by the chief engineer of the ship, Geordi. And he becomes a sympathetic character. He seems to not want to be Borg. He doesn't want to behave in the way the Borg have behaved previously, which is violent assimilation. He respects the wishes of his new friends. And eventually, Picard has to come face to face with the fact that when he's sanctioning murder because he thinks the enemy, the Borg, are so terrible, that's not really fair because, look, they're not that terrible. Hugh's all right. So is it okay? Is it morally justifiable to mass murder them? Eventually he says no, and the episode concludes, supposedly, on the right side of things. Our protagonists haven't chosen mass violence, but they have sent Hugh back with knowledge of what it means to be a person, what it means to be an individual, and they think that this, in its own right, will be subversive to Borg society.
I should just say there's one other thing, which is that Picard, in the intervening time between what we discussed in episode 2, Picard was himself assimilated by the Borg. There's a very good two-parter there that takes place before this episode. and well worth watching before watching this one. And so, but some of the issues related to Picard's simulation do come up in the episode.
Absolutely. Well worth checking out if you're interested. End of season 3, beginning of season 4, Best of Both Worlds, part 1, part 2. Okay, as usual, we're going to talk about the episode a little bit, talk about what we liked, what we didn't like, what vexed us or intrigued us, etc. And then we will try and apply our international relations theory to make sense of the episode and see if the episode tells us something about the world, or if the episode maybe presents its own theory of the world and of politics. And then we will conclude with a discussion of the overarching theme of this season, which is liberal utopia. If Star Trek is meant to represent a liberal humanist utopia, what does this episode tell us about what it means to be liberal, what it means to live in this world? Okay, let's get going. What do we want to talk about or begin talking about with this episode?
I want to talk about Hugh. I think he's the absolute star of this episode. I know in the notes you said that he's, you know, he's an amazing actor. But I just think the evolution of the Hugh character is just so well done as he sort of starts to discover his own existential loneliness because he's away from the collective. He starts to discover that he feels friendship towards Geordi in particular. And then at the end when he talks about when he makes a sacrifice, because he says they offer him asylum if he wants to stay and be an individual and he wants to be Hugh, because they know that when he goes back, they will, you know, expunge that bit of his memory because it will be a threat to the collective. And he says the only thing is that he has to go back because otherwise he would put the rest of them in danger. And then and it's just lovely. And he says at the end, he's like, I do not want to forget that I am Hugh. And it's just so lovely. So I liked that because there's a lot about this episode that's really chilling. But the stuff about friendship and connection and loneliness, I think is really moving. And so I wanted to start with that before we get into the genocidal mania underpinning the whole episode.
Very good. Let's just clarify for everyone who maybe didn't watch the episode or haven't encountered the Borg yet, things like the collective assimilation. I described them as techno-zombies earlier in the introduction. They're like a hive mind. So the idea is that because of this crash, this individual who identifies as 305 and then eventually is given a name Hugh, he's cut off from what he's normally connected to. He talks often in the episode about, don't you hear voices? Because he's connected to thousands, hundreds, thousands of other people, Borg, all at the same time. So he's always hearing voices in his head, even when he sleeps, he says. And now he's cut off from this by virtue of this crash. He's having to discover what it means to be himself apart from the collective. And when he goes back to the collective, if he goes back, when he goes back, they have an understanding. As Dan says, Picard was one of them, so he knows very much how they operate. And he knows that when Hugh rejoins the collective, he'll just have his memory wiped and he'll just become part of this amorphous hive mind once again. So these are kind of the stakes, sort of. Him going back is, yeah, it's very moving because he's expunging his individuality. He's experiencing some kind of death, really. The Hugh that we've come to know in this episode ceases to exist when he joins the collective, or at least so we think. The story does continue in a later season, but for now, that's what's happening. Dan.
Yeah, and it's lovely. He asks Geordi, doesn't he? Because Geordi says it sounds like you're lonely, and then later on he asks Geordi, like, well, do you ever get lonely? And Geordi says, yes, that's why we have friends, someone to talk to make you feel better. I just loved it. I thought it was lovely.
Yeah, and that moment happens and he learns from it so that when later Guinan, who's a character who we've previously talked about, and if you're getting lost in characters, do remember we have an episode 0, about 10 minutes long, where we explain each of the main characters that we'll talk about on first name terms as we proceed. Guinan, who is something of a confidant to the captain and who knows the most about the Borg, apart from Picard, because her people were extinguished by the Borg. The Borg encountered them a long time ago and wiped them out, and they only exist now in pockets around the galaxy. And so she hates them. She really hates them. And she goes to visit the Borg for whatever reason in this episode, and she's explaining that the basis of that hatred. You know, you wiped us out. My people don't exist as they used to, but we persist, in our small numbers. And then Hugh says, oh, so you're lonely. Because he's just learned that word and what it means from Geordi, the engineer. And it shocks Guinan that Hugh, the Borg, is empathizing with her and says, you know, I feel lonely too. So he's the perpetrator of the violence against her, but he sympathizes with her as the victim of that violence because he's now feeling the same. So it's, yeah, this loneliness thing is really, really hits hard, doesn't it? Dan, should we bounce to you?
Yeah, I really like this episode. It's kind of your classic Star Trek moral conundrum that it does really well. The various crew members end up poking and prodding Picard, and they eventually sort of steer him into changing his mind. That being said, Worf is also quite interesting in this episode. When they first find Hugh alive on the planet, I believe his words are "kill it now," and then he suggests that we cover it up afterwards. And he pretty much does not change his attitudes. He's permanently suspicious of this Borg. Later on in the episode, Picard finally agrees to meet with Hugh, who's transported into the captain's ready room, and the captain asks Worf to leave, and then there is a look that Worf gives that, like, are you fucking kidding? Like,
yeah, brilliant. Worf wants to kill him and cover it up, like, make it look like it was an accident, is what he says. Make it look like he died in the accident.
That doesn't sound very honourable, does it? That doesn't sound very Klingon.
That's true. And he never gets a moment, unlike the others. Everyone else is suspicious, right? Geordi, who, as the engineer of the ship, has to sort of treat the Borg, both him and Beverly, who's the ship's doctor, because the Borg are half organic, half technological. He needs both the doctor and the engineer to sort of understand what's happening with Hugh, fix him up, and then develop this awful weapon that they're going to use against the Borg. And Beverly, the doctor, begins sympathetic. In fact, she's the catalyst for why they bring the Borg on board. They're all like, well, there's Borg here, let's leave them. At best, leave them to die. At worst, kill them and then leave. And she's the one who says, no, it's a wounded being, Borg or not. Like, I'm a doctor and I've got to save this person's life. So, and she forces their hand, sort of, to bring the Borg on board. So she's always sort of on side, but everyone else is suspicious. Worf, okay, yeah, he's the most violently disposed. But Geordi, the captain, Riker, everyone who meets this Borg is suspicious of it. But Worf's the only one who doesn't get a change of heart. Everyone else got a chance to change their mind. You know, they meet the Borg, they realise the error of their ways. Worf, yeah, we didn't get to see that. Maybe it happened, who knows?
I also love the way Beverly is always coming along with her pesky Hippocratic Oath and her humanitarian values, because this is a theme that's come up in other episodes, where she always wants to, like, do this, and then, like, they're always like, no, and then, yeah.
There's a line that Picard says to
About her humanitarian.
He says it with such disdain.
Yeah. Dr. Crusher decided for humanitarian reasons to care for it.
And it's like there's like a pause, decided for humanitarian reasons to care for it. Because he's talking with a fellow hater, like him and Guinan are the two who've been most wronged by the Borg. And so they're both chatting to each other, and Guinan's saying, like, why? I know you hate the Borg as much as I do. Why have you let them on board? And he explains, oh, Crusher, humanitarian.
That pesky doctor and her pesky Hippocratic
liberal do-gooder, woke.
Liberal.
Which is a bit out of context, out of character.
Because he's so traumatized, and like the opening scenes, I mean, the trauma look in his face was the first thing that I noticed, because of course Patrick Stewart is such an amazing actor. It's just his own like trauma, and then look, Guinan must be the same.
Yeah,
well, it's interesting. Like towards the start, Counselor Troi sort of interjects and kind of confronts Picard's. And it's a bit unclear what her agenda is. Like, she seems to be pushing a few of his buttons to try and see sort of how he's doing. But the impression I was getting was the fact that he let Hugh, the character who turns out to be Hugh, onto the ship was sort of the problem that she had with him. It wasn't so much that she thought, well, he's traumatized, he might need some support here. It was more, he's traumatised and he's making irrational decisions and potentially dangerous ones, was what I got from that, which was a bit unlike Troi. That's not her sort of standard approach.
Yeah, although she was still also on board with the genocide. They were all, like, totally up for it, apart from Bev. Shocking.
Speaking of being up for genocide, we haven't explained how they get there. Picard and the Doctor and Geordi, the engineer, are all standing around thinking, what do we do with him? And they explain that some system is damaged and they'll need to manufacture some new component for the technological side of him and install it. And Geordi's like, yeah, I could probably do that. And then Picard just has a light bulb moment from nothing. He says, well, if we're making a new component, we can also like add a little something to it, a little spicy something. And when he reconnects to the Borg Collective, when they come and pick him up, what we add will spread like a virus. And if anyone's following the discourse of the Israeli government at the moment, this will all sound very familiar because Picard justifies this on the grounds that there are no civilians among the Borg. They've declared war on our way of life. This is an existential fight. So this is justified. We're going to murder all of them. And he's very open about that. He says, as the crew are, well, mostly it's just at this point, Dr. Crusher saying, you know, you're talking about exterminating all of the Borg. How can you do this? And he replies, we're justified to do anything when survival is at stake. We'll get to how that plays into liberal utopia later, but yeah, this is, as Sarah said at the beginning, quite chilling at times. They hatch the plan, they're going to do the genocide, and then various people, and they don't use the term genocide, what do they call it? Exterminate the entire species is, I think, something that's said.
It's interesting that they don't use the term genocide, and we can talk about that in the next section, about the politics of actually mobilising that term.
Yeah. But then what's interesting, and you picked it up in your notes, Sarah, I see, there's sort of a cult-like acceptance of this.
Yeah, that's what's sort really, of
people
really
have chilling. Their personal concerns, including the Doctor, she says, I'm here to help, but I don't have to like it. And if we complete that sentence for her, I'm here to help commit a genocide, but I don't have to like it.
Yeah. It's really scary. It's really scary. But then it's also, I mean, isn't this how certainly the Holocaust unfolded, with lots of people going, well, I'm not really into this, but I'm going to like contribute in some small way. I mean, so in that way, it's really instructive, but I mean, it is scary to see it, especially against this supposedly super progressive human future, to see that.
As I understand it, Pop, with the Holocaust, one of the ways in which it kind of fermented and spread was that a lot of people were kept in a condition where they suspected something but didn't know what they were doing was contributing to this. So there was an informational kind of dissonance where some people who were, for instance, involved in logistics, moving Jewish people to concentration camps, did not necessarily know what was going to happen, and very few people had all the information to put it together. But this is quite different within this episode. You have essentially a cabal forming of people who all know what they're talking about.
Yeah, even Geordi. Geordi says, oh, I have some problems with this. I'm having second thoughts. I have some problems with this. And then he just goes... Then Picard talks to him and says, well, it's like animal testing. I mean, so stop, get disattach yourselves from this Borg. We've got to like do this. And Geordi's like, oh, all right then. And I'm like, I'm there going, what? this is weird. No one's taking a moral stand or anything.
Should we explain how the method through which this is going to be enacted? Because it's a bit of an unusual one. What to me is unclear is, so like it's like logical puzzle that can't be solved. And it keeps getting shunted around different subroutines and reprocessed endlessly by the collective. But it's not actually clear that that's going to kill people. It doesn't actually explicitly say that. It's more that it will sow discord within the ranks of the Borg, or it will have unpredictable outcomes. And that's one of the things that I found quite interesting. They didn't necessarily know what this would do. It was more an educated guess. But it wasn't, strictly speaking, a virus. Nor was it an attack, like a conventional attack either. It was something quite dissimilar to that.
Yeah,
which makes sense in a way of the Borg being quite this kind of unusual threat that we discussed in episode two. That you would also have an unusual means of neutralizing that threat.
Yeah, you're right. They don't explicitly say that this mechanism that we've talked about as a virus until now is going to lead to necessarily the death of the Borg, only that they all hope that it will, because the language around it, as we've said, has been, they've explicitly said, we're going to exterminate them. Picard says it's going to be a terminal virus, so that they're hoping, we can say that they want it to be death, but will it actually cause that? We don't know.
And this is also quite revealing, I think, because for the Federation, at this stage, they know more about the Borg than when they first met them, but there's a lot more they don't know. So to assume that the method that they have got will automatically lead to the outcome they believe it will is potentially optimistic thinking, or quite reductionist thinking as well. Mm. And one of the things that we see as a later in a different different season of the Next Generation is the outcome of this kind of like, well, we'll, instead of using this kind of logic puzzle that will sow destruction, we will introduce Hugh's experiences of individual freedom into the collective, and that may have a ripple effect as well. And it does have a ripple effect, but it doesn't play out in the way that they think it does, because that Borg cube, yes, it causes a lot of issues on the Borg cube, and results in a lot of chaos within that, but that Borg cube is just disconnected from the entire Borg system and then gets kind of manipulated by Data's rogue brother, Law.
So they develop this mechanism. Hugh's learning to be a human, learning to be an individual. We talked about earlier, Hugh empathizes with Guinan, which changes her mind. She then speaks to the captain and says, like, are you sure? You need to go speak to this guy.
And he becomes visibly agitated during that discussion and starts shouting. Is that unusual for Picard?
Yes, it's trauma. Which is interesting, because it kind of suggests that this is a man who's out of sorts, who's into this genocide, rather than just something that people do perfectly rationally.
So this feeling we have, this sort of quiet terror that we're carrying with Picard's plan and then everyone just going along with it, I guess that's purposeful? Is that to the credit of the episode and the way it's structured and everything? Because in the end, of course, he doesn't do this, and Picard himself says, I avoided meeting the Borg because I didn't want a reason to not execute our plan.
Mm.
So you're sort of adding weight to this idea that he was out of sorts, and he kind of knew it, but he wanted to go through with it anyway. And so as the audience, yeah, we're meant to be terrified by what's happening, and we're then meant to, you know, have a sigh of relief that, when functioning properly, the Federation wouldn't do this. Which is interesting, and I guess we'll get to it in the next section. But Picard goes to see him. Picard gets Hugh to come to him and does so using the transporter, which they rarely do. Usually in Star Trek you can dematerialize somebody and then rematerialize them somewhere else, and they use this to travel large distances, for example, moving instantaneously from the ship to the planet. They rarely do it within the ship. Like, you can just walk and see each other. There are these so-called turbo lifts, which are as they sound. But this is a rare instance where he asks for the transporter to take Hugh from the detention cell where he's in directly to the captain's ready room, the captain's office, which I thought was interesting. I thought it was a way to hide the fact that it's like a power play, right? He doesn't want to go to the Borg, and he doesn't want to be seen going to the Borg and having dialogue with the Borg. So by transporting him, no one knows what's happening, which I thought was also out of character for Picard.
But just as an aside, like, I was part of the Star Trek Society at Sussex, now defunct Star Trek Art Society.
You can tell the truth.
But the...
it was the Star Trek Society.
Thank you. But one of the things that was pointed out by another member was that the turbo lift, and I hadn't noticed this, but you can't unnotice it when you notice it, because it goes down the sort of the spine of the ship, and then it stops, and then it goes sideways, and you see that in the lift, it pauses, and then it sort of rejigs the noise. So when they're going down to engineering or something like that, that is actually reflected in how the turbo lifts the journey, which I was... It's a nice attention to detail there.
I've never noticed it. I'm going to keep an eye out next time.
I'll also say, just as an aside, like one of the members of the society, that he really wanted the background hum of the Enterprise on, sort of in his day-to-day life, and somebody uploaded 24 hours of like ambient noise from the Enterprise, which you can listen to.
we'll play around with having it running at the, in the background as we speak in the next episode of the podcast. Picard meets Hugh, right, in the office, and then he's recognised. Hugh recognises him as a former Borg, because Picard had been assimilated in this two-part episode, Best of Both Worlds, that we mentioned earlier. And then Picard takes advantage of that and says, yes, I am Picard the Borg, so you need to help me assimilate this vessel, because we're both Borg, right? And he really pushes Hugh, like orders him to help him assimilate the crew, particularly Geordi, and Hugh refuses. He's like, no, Geordi doesn't want this to happen. I refuse. Picard says, but resistance is futile. You are Borg. You have to do this. And he's like, no, I am Hugh.
And then he says, resistance is not futile, which is just classic.
Okay, so I'm going to say this is my one major problem with this episode. And I think Hugh is a great character, and he goes on to continue to be a really interesting character. But I would dispute that he is an individual in this episode, because he's largely parroting things that Geordi has said to him, and including in that exchange with the captain. And so it's like taken as like a test that convinces the captain, oh wait, that there is an individuality lurking behind the Borg's kind of harsh collectivism. But actually, it's not really clear that's what's happening here. This is a confused, isolated Borg who is adapting to a new environment, which is the other way around to how the Borg usually do it. They force people to adapt to them, but the Borg is having to adapt to an external environment, and is kind of feeling his way around that.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they totally like anthropomorphize. Like, go, oh, you're feeling lonely. You know, like they're totally like projecting all their own self-understandings. And that's quite an interesting political process in itself, isn't it? That how we encounter the other and how we can make sense of alterity and difference. We really struggle with that, actually.
Picard addresses that point somewhat head on when someone tries to tell him, Guinan tells him after she's spoken with Hugh that he's a person, he's an individual. And Picard shouts back at her, you know, he's not a person. Just because he's young doesn't mean he's innocent. No, just because it's young doesn't mean it's innocent. Refuses to use personal pronouns. And he says, yes, exactly. Yeah. He says, I'm not going to be swayed just because everyone wants to turn him into a pet. So he's kind of making those points somewhat. And that's a bad thing, because by using that, he's able to maintain his distance from Hugh and continue with his genocidal plan.
Yeah, and I mean, because Geordi earlier on in the show explicitly compares Hugh to a kind of a lab rat that he's conditioning, though Geordi then moves away from that view. But in that scene that Sarah referred to earlier, Picard he gives a cautionary tale of when scientists became too attached to their lab animals, and this caused problems. Was what he said.
When they had to kill them. Problems when they had to kill them.
Yeah. And this is basically a kind of not so subtle sort of warning to Geordi, back off. You'll be doing as I say.
Which is strange to me. It doesn't sound very utopian to be like, yo, science kills animals. Fact.
Chill.
Whenever they make allusions in the show to things akin to animal testing, I wonder if I have examples off the top of my head. Certainly, they talk about war, they talk about famine, they talk about disease. They talk about it as a unfortunate thing of the past, you know, like we don't do that anymore and it was wrong to have done it. But in this case, he's saying, yo, we used to do this, you need to get with the program. Like, what?
Actually, thinking about it, genocide is sort of an ongoing theme of Star Trek. Even Picard, the newest stuff that you don't like, it ends up with a whole like thing about genocide and Picard reflecting on the role of the Federation in their current predicament that they're in the future. This is,
Or we could think about a better show like Deep Space Nine, which also does it with regards to the changelings.
Well, yeah, but that isn't that link, that's linked to this, isn't it, in Picard at the end?
Linked is a generous word. Made undead.
You didn't even watch till the end. You are slating it and you didn't even watch it all. I know exactly what you bailed out.
I did narrate to him.
You were texting about it.
Yeah, I did narrate to Fires how Picard season three unfolded. So in fairness,
I loved season three. It was brilliant.
No.
I'm totally missing out.
Oh, dear.
I thought I might watch it again. Like now.
Apologies. Put it in the background of this.
Yeah. If Sarah doesn't return, you'll know why. Excellent. Okay, that's the episode, more or less. It wraps up in 5 minutes. Like,
yeah. All resolved.
Like, really quickly, though, right? After this meeting with Q, when Q meets Picard and he changes his mind, I feel like there's only a few minutes left of the episode and they have to quickly, move the pieces to the end, which is a shame because I think there's a lot in those few minutes which we're going to then unpack in the next section. So let's move on. Now we'll try and talk a little bit about some of the academic concepts and the ways in which we understand the world and how they might apply to the episode, or whether the episode has something to say to us. We've talked a bit about genocide. Maybe we start there.
I think there's loads in here about, violence, war, perpetrators and victims, how you construct an enemy and how kind of unstable that is. But I guess we could start by talking about international law and and how we tend to think about that. So in our storytelling of international law, certainly in Western contexts, we think about it as a way of restraining force, right? Restraining the use of force by not killing civilians and having these sort of moral and ethical kind of considerations that so you can have a just and unjust war, right? That whole Michael Walzer kind of stuff. But there is a considerable amount of people that actually talk about international law in the way that its purpose is to legitimate killing civilians, because it makes it okay if you do it within certain boundaries. So a sort of counterintuitive point. And I think this is playing out, you see this playing out when they're arguing about the genocide early on in the episode. I think it's really interesting when they have that initial discussion in the boardroom about this idea, and Bev's the only one that is like, no. And Riker's like, well, we're at war. And it's like, guys, like, what happened to, like, any kind of restriction on this? And even Troy gets in on it and talks about how they, they're like an undefeatable kind of enemy, and so kind of like anything goes. And I think that's quite interesting for the episode, because I'm like, is it trying to tell us? In the end, it ends up kind of telling us that this was just a bit of a madman, a bit of madness, and they saw the light and they didn't do it, so everything's okay. So in the end, the episode does end up like that. But for that brief moment in that boardroom where they're talking about they're at war, all of the pretenses of all these things that we have that are supposed to restrain violence and make it just fall away. And you can see what happens when you have this constructed enemy. It's almost like anything goes. And I found that quite subversive. I think that's quite interesting.
It also shows that there is a considerable amount of fear that is required. That's the fuel that makes this kind of thing possible.
And then, of course, we see it playing out with the Gaza situation, conflict, genocide. You know, again, there's all the politics around how you name that. But it's the same thing, isn't it? Israel has a right to defend itself, right? So therefore, we won't look at the means. That's some of the logic that you get from certain politicians. So it's really interesting. And there's some quite interesting work from international legal people about, like, this is really laying bare the complete farce that is international law when it comes to conflict.
Yeah, and I think with this episode, it does a good job of, I suspect perhaps unintentionally, sort of replicating how genocides have tended to function, which is one, they always occur in context of war. And so we see this with some of the language around Gaza, where people who are saying this is not a genocide are saying, well, it's actually just war. You've misinterpreted this as being genocide, whereas you cannot have genocide without war. So it's a bit of a false distinction that's being drawn there. But we also see a tendency towards secretive decision making by an elite that is separate from society and is where instructions are filtering down, albeit unevenly, and I think the show kind of does a good job of replicating that. And one of the things that that I really actually applaud the show for doing, again, I don't, not sure if this is quite the intention, but it shows genocide from the perspectives of those committing it, or those who want to commit it, rather than those on the receiving end, and the different thought processes that occur within that. And I think it's really useful to try and like flip that around. There's a really it's a really good book on like account interviews with the genocidaires in Rwanda. What was their reasoning? What was their motivation? How did they feel when they were conducting it? Was there a collective spirit which seemed to emerge in certain cases? And that's something that's often left out, I think, of the liberal imagining of politics, where genocide is seen as something that's an aberration rather than something that at times can serve certain functions and purposes, including collective bonding.
And also, I mean, and broadly we can talk about, and this is a big theme in IR, isn't it, broadly about legitimate and illegitimate violence. And you've got like a whole spectrum of things, haven't you? You know, the whole one man's terrorist, another man's freedom fighter. You've got stuff around total war and civil war and how we divide all these different things up and what's acceptable. And then you've got, is it a genocide or not? And so actually the language and the rationalities that we use actually enable certain forms and legitimize certain forms of violence and not others. And so this episode really kind of, I think, shows that. And that's a really important area of kind of research.
So I think one of the interesting things with this episode is discussions of genocide and the nature of the Borg themselves, because depending on how you conceptualise genocide, they're either not necessarily committing genocide, or at least not consciously doing so, or they are creating what might be called social death in groups by depriving them of the fundamental tenets of their existence. But they... The Borg have a relentless kind of almost a compulsion to assimilate and absorb people, and from the perspective of the Federation, they could well legitimately see this as being a type of genocidal violence, which might be one of the reasons that they are so quick to go to the genocide route.
When we watch this at the University of Sussex seminar series last year, I had three colleagues give some thoughts, having watched the episode for the first time. Two of them were beginners to Star Trek. One of them had probably seen the episode before, was well-versed in science fiction and Star Trek. The first postgraduate researcher, Rand Saber, she more or less speaks in the terms we've been speaking with regards to genocide, but with a focus instead on Xinjiang and the Chinese, shall we say, re-education of the Uyghur minority. And she saw parallels with this episode, given how the Federation re-educate Hugh away from whatever mode of life he had into this supposedly better one, according to them. And I found that super fascinating, and it speaks to what Dan said about we're seeing the perpetrators of genocide. And then Dr. Lindsay Clark talked about, who does research on drone warfare, she talked about a particular moment in the episode where they describe Hugh as childlike, but clearly dangerous. And this resonated with her research. She said, you know, we're talking about technologically advanced beings with technologically advanced ways of war, but moral immaturity. And what does that mean for the future, especially for our liberal utopia? And then the last speaker is going to take us in a different direction, and I want to throw this in now, which was Dr. Steffi Ortmann. And she said, in her viewing, this was nothing to do with genocide. And she went in another direction and said, this is the end of the Cold War on screen. And she says, this is, and it kind of works for our podcast as well, because in our episode 2, when we first encountered the Borg, we did call them somewhat maybe communists of the 24th century. not actual communists, communists as they're depicted, the USSR as it was depicted in, let's say, the US, the evil empire. And the Cold War is ending or has ended. Has ended. This is 1992, 93. And this is an episode which shows that even the enemy aren't so bad. Even the enemy can learn to be human or learn to be individual like us. So she saw it as like a rehabilitation of the former enemy. And it was less, as I say, to do with genocide and violence, even though we've talked about the ways in which it's quite explicit in the episode, at least in the language that's being used around mass death, extermination, etc. But I think that's quite interesting, worth thinking about.
I'm not sure I'd agree with that, partly because I don't necessarily see the Borg as one of the things we discussed in episode two as being in some way a communist force or communist society. I think there's more to it than that. But I would also say, I think actually, I would take part of Steffi's point and interpret it differently, which is that the genocide route that is being touted by Picard and co. is abandoned after they realise that basically they have a crisis of conscience because they start to see elements of themselves being projected or otherwise on Hugh. And so at that point, we won't kill you because you remind us of us. It is going on there, I think, at least.
Yeah, no, I mean, but I think that's quite interesting that the way that once you've created an enemy and you've dehumanized them, that you've created, like in the case of the Cold War, the evil empire, and create this whole kind of fear about that, like Red's under the bed in the early Cold War and all of this, you have to then go through a process where somehow you try and like normalize those relationships. So I think there is something quite interesting about how they have to make Hugh like them a bit to kind of enable that process of relating, which again tells us something about how liberal kind of societies actually engage with others. We need to find commonality. And so it's like the introduction of capitalist kind of economics and like in the USSR and the idea that they can be individual, you know. So I can see that how that is about the end of the Cold War.
What's interesting later on, and this is venturing into the territory of Picard, the series, at the end of Voyager, the ship Voyager has been cast out into a remote part of space, and the whole series is about them making their way back to Earth. They do so by using the Borg's own infrastructure, and in the process dismantle that infrastructure by basically sort of putting fancy space bombs around parts of it, thus separating the Borg from one another. Now, this is something that clearly weakens the Borg. It's not clear if it is intended to wipe them out permanently, whether there's much debate over that. But what happens in Picard is you start to see remnants of the Borg involved in this reclamation project. So Hugh actually comes back in Picard series one as the director of this reclamation project. And one of the things that he is concerned about is how marginalised the Borg are and how they're not seen as proper equals within either the Federation or Romulan societies. So it's quite interesting that of this kind of selective integration where that we see Hugh is being welcomed because he has some similarities to the Federation and exhibits those, but his complaint later on is, well, yes, but the emphasis on some similarities, we are treated as second class citizens or not citizens at all.
Star Trek Picard, what can we say? It's just terrible. It's not. I get it, people like it, but how annoying is it that we're talking about a show, we're having to explain what Picard does, and then when we talk about the show Picard, we're also using the same word. It's just confusing.
Unhelpful.
The way in which they conclude and they end the episode with this idea that, well, we're not sending back a violent virus that will disable the Borg, potentially kill them all. We're going to send back individuality. We'll send them an experience of what it means to be like us.
The greatest and gift of all.
The greatest gift of
it
all.
It is. Well. That is definitely the vibe.
To be like us. And when this is followed up in a later season of Star Trek The Next Generation, and this this show, we find that it had some kind of effect, and some Borg were got a taste of what it meant to be individual, but then what? The Federation weren't exactly there to help them, and they had to fight for themselves, and they became disenchanted with the Federation because, you know, what good is this individualism if we just have to fight the Borg on our own? They were abandoned, essentially, and then a grifter comes in and ends up manipulating them. But that's not important. The important part is this dynamic reminded me very much of the way the US dropped leaflets in Iraq over the Kurdish regions to inspire a revolt. They said, you know, if you rise up against Saddam Hussein, we're going to be there, we're going to help you. And the US didn't help. And the Kurds, Saddam took a retributive campaign of violence against the Kurds and murdered a whole lot of people. At the instigation of the US, which seems to me a similar dynamic here, where Picard's like, we're going to send this one guy back, he's going to individualize the Borg, and good luck to him. Yeah. Which I guess is not quite the same, because at least the US had said that they would help. Picard doesn't send him back saying, and when you get free within the Borg collective, you know, here's my phone number, we'll come and help you out. He never says that.
It's a really irresponsible position, because he really does not know what the consequences of his actions will be here. Perhaps Worf was right, kill it now.
This is just exactly how much of certainly the second half of the 20th century played out in terms of people engaging with, like, the West. I mean, they, mm-hmm. you know, imposing their economic regimes, basically imposing, using... you know, the desperation of many of these countries as a result of colonialism and all the rest of it, like imposing this Western model of democracy, Western human rights, kind of when it suits us. That so in terms of a modus operandi, I think this episode pretty much embodies this. Like, you have to be like us.
Yeah.
That's the best way to be, and we'll intervene, and you might, you know, to kind of enable that, but we won't see it through, and we won't think about the consequences, and there'll be all these unintended consequences. And do you even want to be like us anyway?
Let's then jump to the last segment of the show and continue the conversation in the discussion of what this means for liberal utopia, because this idea that you bring up, Sarah, I think is super relevant with regards to liberal patronage, the idea of, like, first here and then the rest of the world, first the West, then the rest, which places the rest, or in this case the Borg and Hugh, in a eternal pupilage. Like, they're always the student. Hugh and the Borg can't possibly become like the Federation unless they are... No, what do I want to say? Hugh can only be an individual as long as he thinks the same as Picard and co. And if he has any other ideas about this, then he just hasn't learned his lesson well enough. Yeah. And that must be still a residual effect of his Borginess. And this is something that I know comes up in Star Trek Voyager, and I think Sarah... was watching an episode where this exact dynamic plays out, because Hugh is such an interesting character that I think they decide to have a Hugh of their own in Star Trek Voyager, but make that character part of the crew. So you've got this former Borg who's part of the Starship Voyager. And that character, I don't know, Sarah, if you want to say it, since you're the one who watched it, tell us what happens with Seven.
Yeah, I sent you the video of it. Yeah. This is how nerdy I am. And it's just a massive showdown. And the character, Seven of Nine, the character who is the Borg, you know, former Borg, who was assimilated at a very young age, who's on the Voyager crew, ends up calling out Captain Janeway and basically saying, yeah, you want me to be an individual, you want me to think for myself, but only if I think like you do. As soon as I start to have a different idea, then you punish me. She actually said, I get punished. And it's classic. And Janeway doesn't know what to say, and she has to just like walk out because like she's like totally right. And I just think that is just such a powerful scene. And so again, this is one of the themes that crops up through all of the Star Treks, is like we have this liberal universe, but here are the limits of it, and here are its inherent kind of problems, and they don't get resolved. And in that episode in Voyager, it doesn't get resolved in the way that it does in the one that we've been talking about today, where they're like, oh no, we've come to our senses, it's all fine. That one, it doesn't. It's just left hanging, and I really like that.
And then for Liberal Utopia, again, we've mentioned that the violence, potentially genocidal violence, which is about to be unleashed by our protagonists, is or is not representative of this liberal utopia. Now, this is, I think, what I wanted to like talk about a little bit now. In the show, it's presented as if plausibly it could be, and then eventually it's not when they change their minds. And then, so which one, I don't know, which one is the right answer? Which one is procedurally what the Federation would do in any other situation? Because earlier in the episode, they do say, I think Picard says, normally mass murder would be looked down upon.
He says unconscionable.
But I found a loophole.
But yeah. So the fact that normally it would be means there are some exceptions. They simply have found one of these exceptions. So there are other exceptions in the history of the Federation. Have they also found an exception to exterminate somebody? In the future, will it happen? Spoiler, it will. Watch Deep Space Nine. But yeah, which is the liberal utopia winning out when they choose not to, you know, wage this mass murder? Or are we seeing liberal violence in practice, in its mundane, dehumanizing justification of violence in the majority of the episode? And or is the liberal utopia that last 5 minutes when they change their mind? That's what I want to sort of get to.
There's a dual face to the Federation, and this is seen in several episodes of Next Generation, particularly whenever an admiral comes in, and the admirals are almost invariably evil characters who often have some kind of like ulterior motive, the sort of manipulating or pressuring Picard to doing something that he doesn't feel is right. And we can sort of see that with this particular episode called The Pegasus, which is about a...
That's a classic, by the way. I love that episode.
It's a great episode, which involves a mutiny, or at least one that happened in the past, on a starship due to them breaching a technological restraint as part of their kind of sort of ceasefire with the Romulans, which is the Federation don't get an advantage by developing cloaking technology. And we see this again in Deep Space Nine with a secretive organisation called Section 31, that comes to prominence. No one's really clear where their actual authority comes from. It's left very ambiguous what the extent of this organisation is. It just one person? That sort of seems to be implied at one point, who's just this kind of rogue element moving around the Federation. Is it a larger entity within it? And I think that this episode, the Iborg, the one we're discussing, shows an interesting way, and it brings this the internal contradictions of the Federation into much sharper relief.
I think in this episode, if you watch it on its own, yeah, it can be read as like the liberal utopia kind of wins the day because they come to the senses, and this whole episode, you know, it's all an aberration. But when you look at it in the context of the series entirely and the other series, I think it does show the mundane workings of liberal violence, because you just, I mean, that's why it's so chilling, because they're all just like developing this genocidal weapon with a smile with this guy that they're kind of befriending. I mean, it's really sinister, and there's no real debate or like ethical kind of any kind of, I mean, they just go along with it. And that's what happens. That's what happens all the time. That's why so many people get killed in conflict. That's part of it. And of course, colonialism was exactly that and continues to be that, and that is part and parcel of liberalism. So yeah, depends which context, which lens you're using to look at it at. That's what I think. What do you think, Vise?
It's one of those where I want the liberal utopia to be those 5 minutes at the end where they change their mind, and I want this to be an example like in The Drumhead, where in our, you know, in that episode, I think we discussed it in episode 3 of the podcast, we made parallels with the War on Terror and a sort of a similar moment, a political or violent moment in our past, and the decisions we made, which weren't great, versus the better decision made in the show. And I want to look at this episode as another example of that, where, you know, we have, as Sarah's outlined, these historic moments, continuing moments of liberal violence. We're conducting a war for the benefit of Western civilization, says the Israeli president at the moment. This is a battle between the light and the dark. All this language, which is exactly the language used in this episode by the Federation and our protagonists when discussing violence against the Borg. It sounds like a similar moment in time. But they, in the show, they don't go there. And they find another way. And I would love for that to be some redemption for what a liberal world order could offer, although it's clearly not doing it at the moment.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. And I think that with the drumheads, this was about institutions prevailing in a way that you had due process, and you had a Starfleet admiral being relatively effective by just getting up from a chair and walking out. but in this episode, there isn't really a place for institutions or procedures. The impression I got was that Picard was kind of acting on his own when he was proposing this idea and trying to implement it. It didn't seem that it was being sort of fed up the chain. Guys, senior Starfleet, do you have any ideas on this? Are you okaying this? That doesn't seem to happen. And conversely, it's not procedures or institutions, the bread and butter of the liberal political worldview, that save the day either. It's just the fact that this is a personal kind of journey that Picard goes on, and it ends up being turned around following the interactions and pressure from other crew members. So in a way, it illustrates that the failure of the liberal utopia to fully embed or stamp upon all of its agents this mentality of using institutions, rules, procedures, norms, this kind of thing.
Yeah. And also later on, Admiral Nechayev has a go at Picard for not using that opportunity when he had it. I can't remember which episode that's in. I watched it recently. And she's like, you should have done that then when you had that opportunity. So there you go. Yeah. They were like, yeah, totally up for it. They would have been totally up for it, the higher echelons of Starfleet Command.
Well, at least the more military side of the Federation in Starfleet. Yeah. If they had gone for Federation Council approval, I wonder.
But yeah.
That's an interesting point. I do like that. I had this thought that, you know, Picard says in this episode that I avoided meeting the guy, Hugh, the Borg, former Borg, because I didn't want to be dissuaded from my vengeance, basically.
Mm.
And I wonder if that's also why he didn't, you know, phone home and ask headquarters, because headquarters might have also had procedural or moral things to say.
Here's the genocide form you've got to fill in. Yeah.
I mean, it could have been that, who knows. But then, yeah, as Sarah's saying, later they do reference this moment and scold him for not doing it. So
I can't remember the episode. Can you remember which one that was? I'm going to have to look it up, because it's going to bug me.
Cool. Then I think we are done for the day with a somewhat inconclusive assessment about what liberal utopia means and how liberal violence works, at least in this episode, although there is a lot of literature out there on sort of liberal violence, the conditions under which states, liberal states, self-proclaimed, will maintain peace at home but willingly conduct violence abroad, etc. And indeed, we're not going to talk too much about this or at all, because we all lived through it. You all remember the invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq and the ways in which a peaceable liberal world justified that violence. Okay, that's it. Shall we wrap up and thank Sarah and Dan?
Thank you, Vice.
Thanks, Vice.
See you in the next episode, where we are discussing Season 7, Episode 9, Force of Nature, which is an episode which is about more or less climate crisis and fossil fuel use in the 24th century. We'll see how that goes in 2 weeks' time. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Intergalactic Relations. This podcast is made possible by the International Relations Department of the University of Sussex. Please subscribe to keep up with the latest episodes.